It is Friday. No, I think it's Monday, actually, April the 24th. This is VOA's International Edition. Very good to have you with us. Coming up, now it's on to the runoff in the French presidential race.
This is the first time in French history that either one of the major established parties on the center-left, the other on the center-right, have not gotten through to the second round of a presidential election.
Also ahead, North Korea detaining yet another American, a possible U.S. government shutdown later this week, plus the death of a renowned soul singer. Hello everyone, I'm Steve Norman. Results from France's first round of presidential elections on Sunday confirmed that centrist candidate Emmanuel Macron and nationalist anti-immigration candidate Marine Le Pen are heading into a runoff in about 2 weeks, marking what analysts describe as a political earthquake in France. Socialist President François Hollande announced earlier this year he would not run for re-election after his approval rating sank to 4%, something analysts widely attribute to a string of terrorist attacks in France and a stagnant economic growth during his time in office. Hollande is the first incumbent president not to seek re-election in the history of modern France. My colleague Lori London joins us now here in the studio with more on the first round of voting in France. Lori?
Well, Steve, I spoke with Paris-based journalist Catherine Field, and the first thing I asked was why the election really is such a big deal, and why does it matter to people here in the United States and the rest of the world?
This election campaign until now has been extraordinary because no one knew how the result would fall. Secondly, the two candidates that go through to the second round to be held on the 7th of May are two diametrically opposed candidates. We have on the one hand Emmanuel Macron, who is centrist liberal candidate. He is open. He is highly educated. He speaks several languages. He shows a face of a young France that can exist and be at ease in a globalized world. On the other, you have Marine Le Pen. She is really complete opposite of that. She is in fact saying that France should close its borders, that it should really put up taxes for foreigners who are working in France, that you should also tax companies 10% extra if they employ foreign workers. She wants to leave the European Union. She wants to leave NATO. All these structures that have been put in place for the stability, the political stability, and the economic stability in Europe would really be at risk if Marine Le Pen won the second round of these elections.
So how big of a deal were Sunday's results? What did the election results say?
One of the major upsets in this election is this is the first time in French history that either one of the major established parties on the center-left, the other on the center-right, have not gotten through to the second round of a presidential election. It is showing that the French voters have just got fed up with the usual political parties that have been running the country. They've been backwards and forwards, center-left government, center-right government, center-left. And the people have seen that really in the last 20 years, unemployment has stayed at 10% on a national average, 25% to 40% for youth unemployment across the country. And that despite everything that politicians have said, their promises have either been not been kept or the policies they've put forward have been somewhat half-hearted, haven't really addressed the economic changes, the economic problems that France has, or there have been suggestions of new policies that as soon as there's been a protest in the street, the ideas have been put in an envelope and put in a drawer somewhere. So it's a real sign from the people that they weren't happy with the what they call the so-called elite that have been running France for the last 50, 60 years.
Who do you think has the most momentum now going into the runoff?
I would say Emmanuel Macron would have it because he's got a very young team. He's got a very savvy team. They know how to do all the social media. If you think about it, Emmanuel Macron has never held elected office. Yes, he was economy minister, but you don't have to have elected office to be a cabinet minister in France. He started his movement 1 year ago. So from 1 year ago, from being a cabinet minister who'd never held elected office, he's now got to the second round of the presidential election. So he's got a lot of momentum. he's built up this momentum over a year. He's now got to carry it through another 2 weeks and really pull in both in the extreme right and the extreme left, a lot of voters to get him over that hurdle and into the French presidential palace.
Would you call this situation a political earthquake of sorts?
Oh, absolutely an earthquake. This has, in a nice way, in that it had always been thought that the elite who went to the elite schools would always run the country and their children would always run the country and they'd look after the country. And in return, the electorate voted them in again. Everyone's still got their summer holidays. Everyone's still got their long weekends in spring. And that was sort of the deal. Now, by throwing out these parties that traditionally have run the country, it is an earthquake.
Certainly here in the United States, everyone thought it was going to be a landslide for Hillary Clinton, and we all saw what happened. So how do you compare the rise of Le Pen to Donald Trump in general?
One thing you have to remember about Marine Le Pen is she's been around a long time. This is the second time she's run for president. She did a little bit better, but don't forget that 5 years ago she got 18% of the vote, and this time around she's only got 21%. So she hasn't really gained that much. At the moment, the polls are showing that Emmanuel Macron will get about 62% of the vote. And in general, we've seen in this campaign up until now, the polls have been roughly about right. So I wouldn't expect too much of an earthquake. It does seem as though Emmanuel Macron does have a bit of work to do, but it looks as though he is the favorite by a long shot going into the second round.
And how about that? Great insights, Lori, from Catherine Field there in Paris. The reaction to this election, at least in the financial world, has been very positive. Tokyo's benchmark index today jumped 1.4%. Investors cheered the news that Macron was leading the far-right candidate, Marine Le Pen. And the euro also sharply up today. Amazing, Lori. I would guess, in fact, I'm certain of it, social media has to be just all abuzz about this.
Oh, most definitely, Steve, most definitely. And, with this growing wave of populism around the globe, the implications of this election, as Catherine said, are really enormous. Now, President Trump, he rode that wave to win, and he has thrown his support behind Marine Le Pen. But so far, since that, he really has not tweeted about the results of her advancing to the runoff. But a lot of people are. A political pollster, Nate Silver, who wrongly predicted Hillary Clinton would win, has tweeted that Le Pen probably is not going to be the next Trump. Anyone who says, this is him saying, anyone who says Le Pen can win because Trump is basically innumerate, he says. Their situations are not at all comparable. Nationalist candidates have done pretty badly since Trump won.
Yeah. Mm.
Now, Le Pen supporters, they're tweeting excitement about her policies. For example, here's one man's tweet congratulating Marine Le Pen. She is the President Trump of the EU. If she wins, no more immigrants. France will be France again. So that does sort of sound a bit like Donald Trump's message as a candidate, right?
It does. It does. Right.
Now, of course, on the other side, you've got people saying congrats to Macron. Mm-hmm. One person writes, "We stand with you against Le Pen's divisive politics. Time to turn the tide and stand up for openness, tolerance, and unity." And finally, given Russia's attempts to interject itself in our election and apparently others, a political strategist in London tweets, "We can expect #Russia to unleash every dirty trick in the book in order to try and swing the second round of the French elections to Le Pen."
Lori, you are absolutely the best. Thank you so much.
No doubt.
VOA's Lori London. This is VOA.
Hello, I am your host, Shaka Salee. Every Wednesday night, the Voice of America's Straight Talk Africa puts you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they talk about the most important social and political issues that affect you.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, Zimbabwe's persistent economic woes cloud its 37th Independence Day celebration. An in-depth discussion on Zimbabwe on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This is VOA's International Edition. U.S. citizen has reportedly been arrested as he tried to fly out of North Korea, becoming the third American to be detained there. The U.S. State Department said it was aware of the reports, but there was no official confirmation of the arrest, which comes at a tense time in relations between Pyongyang and Washington. For some perspective on all of this and on the alleged detention of a man identified as Tony Kim, VOA's Victor Beatty asked Tufts University scholar Soon-Yun Lee what it's all about.
North Korea has been known to arbitrarily detain foreigners, U.S. citizens included, of course. But when it comes to ethnic Koreans, they have exhibited an insidious possessiveness, even if they are U.S. citizens or not South Korean citizens, that is, a citizen of another country. North Korea feels that just by a virtue of being an ethnic Korean, they can do as they will. So this latest detainment, of course, comes on the heels of escalation in rhetoric by both North Korea and the United States. And I would think this is an attempt by North Korea to use this human living individual as a political card against the Trump administration.
This reported detention of Korean-American Tony Kim comes as it is revealed that he was teaching an accounting course at the Pyongyang University of Science and Technology, purportedly run by evangelical Christians, opened about 7 years ago. Is this extraordinary for a Christian university to be allowed to operate in North Korea?
Well, the joint venture, if you will, is extraordinary. It's first of its kind. There is a great deal of missionary impulse, shall we say, loosely defined, not focusing so much on the theology of Christianity, but a desire to change and civilize North Korea with the best of intentions exhibited by Americans as they approach North Korea, whether through diplomatic channels or people-to-people exchange programs or through academia. So in the past, there has been, in particular, one female former teacher who has written an expose on her experience. And I'm sure that irked the North Koreans. So probably people associated with the Pyongyang University of Science and Technology have been watched more carefully by the North Korean authorities. And I doubt very much what Tony Kim's offense is, but whatever it may be, I'm sure North Korea can come up with, cook up any kind of allegation and accusation and arbitrarily detain whomever they want to.
Well, with the possible sixth nuclear test by North Korea, there's still an awful lot of behind-the-scenes diplomatic activity going on. President Trump was to speak with both Japan's prime minister and President Xi of China. There also is going to be a meeting this week in Washington involving U.S. lawmakers, a briefing by Secretary of State Rex Tillerson on North Korea. He's supposed to address the U.N. Security Council this week on North Korea. What's all this diplomatic activity? What does it mean?
I think all this, you know, almost unprecedented flurry of diplomatic activity that is not on the heels, coming on the heels of a major North Korean provocation like a nuclear test, exhibits the growing sense of urgency inside Washington, inside the Trump administration, that the North Korea threat must be addressed. No more can we just kick the can down the road and sort of treat it as a priority to be dealt with later, as all previous U.S. administrations have done. So, you know, it's encouraging to see a great deal of effort made by the Trump administration to reach out to its allies and also to China in an effort to rein North Korea in. But nothing so far means really anything until we see how the Trump administration responds to the next big North Korean provocation. In the past, even administrations under George W. Bush, the George W. administration that was so unfavorably disposed toward North Korea, made all kinds of concessions in the wake of North Korea's escalation, conducting its first nuclear test in October 2006. So political expedient has been the more comforting course of action, even under very hard-nosed, ideologically very unfavorable American regimes. So how the Trump administration is able to maintain this resolve to put financial pressure and diplomatic pressure on North Korea in the wake of the next North Korean provocation is the real test of how the United States will approach North Korea.
That is Soon-Yun Lee. He is a professor of Korean studies in the Fletcher School at Tufts University. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. U.S. federal government budget awaits members of Congress as they return to Capitol Hill this week. Funding to run the government runs out on Friday if a spending agreement is not reached before then. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman explains to my colleague Jim Stevenson that there is a simple disagreement on spending issues, even though both chambers of Congress and the White House are Republican-held.
Jim, Congress is returning from a two-week recess, and there are many things that congressional Republicans and the White House would like to tackle, such as tax reform and perhaps taking another crack at repealing Obamacare. But there is something much more urgent on their plate for this week at least, and that is the fact that federal spending authority, in other words, federal funding, expires on Friday. And unless Congress authorizes new spending, there will be a partial shutdown of the federal government. Essentially, non-essential services will end. Those federal employees who are deemed non-essential will be told to go home. Jim, this sounds awfully familiar to you and I.
You and I have been here long enough to witness a few of these and the effects of them, which actually have been different each time it has happened. This go-around is very interesting because we're in the very early phases of a new administration, and what effects that might have on the White House and also the Republican Party have yet to be seen, obviously.
Jim, we are coming up on the 100-day mark of the Trump administration, and he would be the first president to preside over a federal shutdown this early in his administration. Typically, these things happen later on. And it is rather striking because, of course, Donald Trump is a Republican, and Republicans control both houses of Congress. What is needed is a spending bill, and spending bills cannot be filibustered. In other words, minority Democrats, even if they wanted to, could not on their own block a Republican spending bill. As long as Republicans have the majority votes in both houses of Congress to pass this bill, and as long as Donald Trump is willing to sign it. So in essence, Republicans hold all the cards, but it's not entirely clear that Republicans are going to be unified behind a spending bill. And this is where the drama comes in. Donald Trump wants a sort of initial down payment for constructing or actually expanding the existing border wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. There are a number of other sort of potentially difficult spending issues that have to be overcome. But the big one is what happens with this border wall. Democrats are absolutely opposed to it. If there is even a cent of money, one U.S. cent of money to construct this border wall, Democrats are not going to vote for the spending bill. But there are also a number of Republicans who are somewhat uncomfortable with this idea, or who at least think that this is a fly in the ointment, and that at a time of pressing international concerns from Syria to North Korea and beyond, that this is not the time to be dabbling or to be inviting any sort of breakdown in the federal government.
This is a bit unusual because the president in power usually has the backing of his party, at least early on.
This is something that we have witnessed going back to the campaign, that a lot of what Donald Trump stands for and a lot of what he says causes a certain amount of heartburn and indigestion within his own political party. Here's what's likely to happen. We don't know if what actually materializes between now and Friday is some kind of stopgap spending bill. Congress is very good at that, putting off difficult decisions, extending funding for another few months.
Even years.
Kicking the can down the road and giving themselves a chance to negotiate a larger, grander deal and to presumably come up with the unity that would be required to do this. That is one possibility. There is a thought among Republicans that if they are going to bite this apple, which is border wall construction, that maybe that should be something that should be done for the next fiscal year, give themselves a chance to come up with some sort of unified position on it, if in fact a unified position is there to be had.
Above all the fiscal hawks and policy hawks is our media hawk on the Hill, Michael Bowman, who presides over the Senate. And Michael, thank you so much for joining us today.
Always a pleasure, Jim.
Indeed he is. Many thanks, gentlemen. Still ahead, remembering an American soul singer. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute. New observations by an international team of astronomers show that huge galaxies created some 10 billion years ago during a peak in galaxy formation were comprised of mostly baryonic or normal matter and very little of the mysterious dark matter that tends to dominate much younger galaxies. Astronomers led by Germany's Max Planck Institute for Extraterrestrial Physics made their findings after measuring the rotation of six massive and distant star-forming galaxies. Using the European Southern Observatory's Very Large Telescope, the group of scientists said they found that the outer regions of these old galaxies rotated much slower than areas closer to their cores. That's different than much younger spiral galaxies. The astronomers think this difference suggests that there is less dark matter present in the ancient galaxies than had been expected. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. It's very good to have you with us today. You know what? It is time now for something from our music department. Gooding Sr., the soul singer who was part of the 1970s rhythm and blues group, The Main Ingredient, has died. Authorities say the 72-year-old singer and father of Oscar winner Cuba Gooding Jr. was found dead in a car in the Woodland Hills section of Los Angeles. Los Angeles Coroner's Office says the cause of Gooding's death is still under investigation, but drug paraphernalia and alcohol were found in the car, which was parked on a busy street. Cuba Gooding Sr. rose to fame for songs like Just Wanna Be Lonely when he was lead singer of The Main Ingredient. That fame helped the Gooding family move from New York City to Southern California. Cuba Gooding Sr.'s own father fled Barbados and went to Cuba, hence the name of his son, before becoming a taxi driver in New York City.
Hey, say, wait a minute. Where are you going with that suitcase? Wait a minute, listen. All right, well, you don't have to answer. Just listen.
I don't mind when you say that you're going away. I just don't want to be lonely. And I don't care if we share.
Just don't wanna be lonely.
A song that really thrust the main ingredient in Cuba Gooding Sr. to worldwide fame was Everybody Plays the Fool. It was a huge hit in 1974.
So your heart broke. You sit around moping, crying, crying. You say you even thinking about dying? Well, before you do anything rash, dig this. Everybody plays the fool.
Oh yeah, I think we can all relate, huh? Cuba Gooding Sr. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. Up next, the latest world news. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Monday. Now, a whole lot more from Cuba Gooding Sr.
Thing to do, and there's no guarantee that the one you love is gonna love it. It clouds your mind with emotion. Everybody plays the fool sometimes. There's no exception to the rule. Listen, baby, it may be factual, may be cruel. I wanna tell you, everybody plays the fool.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On April 25th, we observe World Malaria Day. It is an occasion to recognize the global effort to effectively control and eventually wipe out this terrible disease. This year's theme is End Malaria for Good. In 2015, 212 million people became sick with malaria, and over 429,000 died. The World Health Organization, or WHO, reports that 90% of malaria cases were reported in Africa, as were 92% of malaria-related deaths. The good news is malaria is preventable and curable, and there is good reason to believe that we can eliminate it altogether. Indeed, between 2000 and 2015, when the international community intensified its efforts, new cases among populations at risk fell by 29% globally. Nonetheless, a child still dies from malaria every 2 minutes. That is why we continue to focus on prevention. Among the most successful weapons we have against this deadly disease are insecticide-treated nets and indoor spraying with insecticides to kill the mosquitoes that carry the illness-causing parasite. These preventive tools, when coupled with strategies to prevent malaria during pregnancy, low-cost diagnostic tools, and highly effective malaria treatments, have and will continue to dramatically reduce death and disease from malaria. Yet much more needs to be done. To address remaining challenges, including the emergence of drug-resistant malaria, the World Health Organization has developed the Global Technical Strategy for Malaria, which provides a technical framework for all endemic countries as they work towards control and elimination. The first goals to be reached by the year 2020 are to reduce malaria incidence by at least 40%, reduce malaria mortality rates by at least 40%, eliminate the disease in at least 10 countries, and prevent a resurgence of malaria in all countries that are malaria-free. If we are to be successful, donors must step up to help fund the effort. The United States is the largest donor to malaria control and elimination programs, contributing over 50% of all donor funding available to countries for implementation. Still, if the 2020 targets of the Global Technical Strategy are to be achieved, total funding must increase substantially. On this day, we call on our friends and partners around the globe to contribute to the funds to help roll back and eventually eliminate this awful disease once and for all.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's 4 hours universal time.